OTB
AM. Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
It's 7:45 on this Thursday morning and you're very welcome along to OTB AM. A massive couple of days coming up on the international scene in football and in rugby. We'll be chatting to Andy Dunn a little bit later on. Dan McDonald is with us in studio to go through all the football stories. Plenty happening from the press conferences over the last 24 hours. And in the middle of all of that this morning, we're going cooking. We're going out to David Gillick's house where he's going to cook us up some things from his new book, Back on Track. It's a fitness book, it's a wellness book. Most importantly, there's a good bit of grub in the book and he's going to cook us up some eggs. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at Off the Ball or you can comment on the stream if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube. As I said, Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent is our guest in studio for this morning. Dan, how are things?
Hi, Owen. Good morning.
I apologise for not giving you the memo to actually come down to Gillick's house to actually cook some stuff up with us because it was absolutely sensational, the grub he cooked up for all of us, really. Like, he cooked up these five little pots of eggs with cheese and tomato sauce and creme fraiche, which is actually the key ingredient for eggs, I'm after realising.
Right. And like, did he give, I mean, I don't want to ruin the segment, but was there like a little doggy bag or something you could bring something away with you, or was it all consumed on site? Or I don't even know if I want to ruin this, but I mean,
well, when the cameras went off, let's just say that Joe and Keith, who were down filming with us, were kind of trying to scoop it all into their mouth very quickly before we actually got in a taxi to get back to base here. So unfortunately the doggy bag wasn't available.
Right.
But we should have brought something back to base for you. It's really good recipes in the book, really simple things, and to be honest with you, I'm thinking of changing my entire culinary life as a result.
Really?
So it's big statements here.
Is that like a training program thing, or is it just...
Well, you know, it's all training programs in this studio at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of fresh new ways of living my life.
Yeah, well, this could be it.
This could be it, indeed.
Fresh, yeah.
So we'll be bringing that later on. We'll be cooking some food with him. We'll also sit down for an interview with David Gillick. As you can see, that's on the sidebar there in terms of things that are coming up this morning. We'll be bringing you our breakfast menu in about 5 minutes' time. So much to talk about, especially when it comes to Northern Ireland against the Republic of Ireland tonight. Plenty of storylines with regards to the managers. Plenty of storylines with regards to players who may or may not play for the Republic of Ireland one day. David Gillick at around 20 to 9. And then at 9 o'clock, Andy Dunn will be looking ahead to the All Blacks this weekend. The Ireland team named at around lunchtime this afternoon. The All Blacks team has been named. No Sonny Bill Williams as expected. Before all that though, time for the back pages.
OTB
AM. Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
We'll start with the Irish Independent this morning, and it is rugby leading the way. O'Connell says Ireland can still flourish without Schmidt. Paul O'Connell, of course, was in town this week. He was at our Heineken Roadshow in the Olympia a couple of nights ago, and he is hopeful for the future of Ireland should Joe Schmidt elect to leave Ireland. We'll have a decision on that pretty soon. The picture there in the back page is hands across the divide. Republic of Ireland manager Martin and Michael shaking hands there. As you can see, an interesting relationship between them has developed over the last couple of years. It seems to be fine on paper. It's certainly not a whole pile of animosity, but is there still a lot of frostiness there? We're going to get into that in a few moments. But the big one, which really is across a lot of the back pages, is O'Neill talking about Obafemi. The decision is a bit off. He has things to think about. That's Dan, that's your story. We'll get into that, as I say, in a few moments. But one other story, just to mention from the back of the end of this morning, Martin Breteny saying home comforts will continue on the double for Dubs next year. So this is the situation involving Dublin and the Super 8s. There was a tad of controversy this year when Donegal complained to the CCC about the idea that Dublin get two home games. They felt they had two home games in the Super 8s. It depends on your view whether or not you see Croke Park as a home venue for Dublin. Anyway, the GEA said that that is not going to change next year. If Dublin reach the Super 8s, spoiler alert, they will reach the Super 8s, then they will have a home game and their neutral game will also take place in Croke Park. So things are not going to change on that front. In the Irish Examiner this morning, it goes with Glenn Whelan. It hurt the family why Dunphy's Ferrari jibe stung Glenn Whelan. Really interesting stuff from Glenn Whelan, who's been on a bit of a media hiatus for the last couple of years, but he's been put back in front of the mics ahead of his 85th and more than likely his last Ireland cap. Back at the Times Ireland edition then is Whelan says criticism was too personal. That's the same situation there. Again, mentioning the Eamon Dunphy quotes from a few years ago. Five years ago at this point?
I think, yeah, after the Sweden game in September 2013. Yeah, so five and a bit.
How was that already 5 years ago? And Southgate talking about quotas, saying they will not help us. That's Matt Hughes' story there. The Times, the London Times have kind of been on top of that for the whole week. Martin Ziegler saying that only three Premier League clubs would actually be affected by quotas brought into the Premier League post-Brexit. In the Irish Times then this morning, we have got rugby leading the way. Humble Wexford farmer Furlong braced for the ultimate scrum test, says Gerry Thornley. And Schmidt set to start, Toner and Kearney most importantly. So as I say, the team is set to be announced later this afternoon. But Thorny's got the line that Joe Schmidt could make up to four changes for the Ireland starting lineup for Saturday's much anticipated meeting between Ireland and the All Blacks. It is as you would expect. So Sean O'Brien is obviously missing, so you'll have Dan Levy coming in for him. You'll also have Rob Kearney starting, you'll have Gary Ringrose starting, and you'll have Devon Toner starting. So they would be your four changes to the team on Saturday. So no huge surprises, and as tends to happen in the morning, if a reporter is saying these changes might happen, they tend to happen. So that would be the Ireland team we'll be expecting to be announced this afternoon. Andy Dunn coming up a little bit later on to discuss that and to see what he thinks should be the Ireland 23. Just a couple of UK back pages before we get on to the Irish tabloids. It's Claudio Ranieri really leading the way, and in the Guardian it goes with dilly ding dilly dong, Fulham ring the changes. So Ranieri is given a multi-year contract to replace Jokanovic, and yes, Cottagers are 5,000 to 1 to win the Premier League title. Sound familiar? And transfer ban threat, FIFA investigating Chelsea and four others in the Premier League. And look who's back, says the front of the Daily Telegraph sports section. Former Leicester manager Ranieri handed Fulham job, but only after Wenger says no. Got to hand it to Shad Khan and the Fulham hierarchy for actually approaching Arsene Wenger.
Yeah, no, that is a story that's across a couple of the back of the tabloids as well, that they had a pop. But I suppose, you know, you chance your arm. You're in London, you know, that's the thing. Fulham always have that really big London, not the most intense job in terms of like fan support and stuff. Come and live in a nice part of the world. Mm. It's a nice place to go and watch football. And I'd say you give it a bash. Like, if Wenger's out there, you make the call.
Yeah,
you
high risk.
You invite him over, you invite him for a meal, whatever. You know, you've got good options. It's not like you're bringing him up to the northeast to have a look around. I think you realise it's probably not going to go well. You got to think, come on.
Yeah.
You know, I actually don't know if Wenger's still living in London or has he gone back to Paris or what his crack is.
Surely he's gone back to France.
You would have thought so. But London's a pretty, you know, cosmopolitan city. He could have his own,
it's not bad.
He could have his own haunts that he likes to go to on a regular basis, you know, and Fulham probably wouldn't be too detached from those places.
Yeah, but we will see him back in management, apparently, in 2 months' time. AC Milan is probably the link that's most concrete at the moment, just because of the Gazidis link.
Yeah, that would be an interesting one, all right. Yeah.
You've got the tabloids this morning?
Yeah, again, a bit of a split between Obafemi and Glenn Whelan with the Herald here, age-old issues, and basically Aidan Fitzmaurice speaking about, just, you know, the eligibility wars and perhaps how, for Martin O'Neill, the Northern Ireland game could have been a problematic one in any circumstances, but this particular issue of eligibility is almost overshadowing the derby aspect of this game, which is unusual. It's like a domestic issue again. The Mail as well, Philip Quinn, waiting game. O'Neill patient while Obafemi weighs up his future, admitting he's some distance away from pledging his future. So, that one, it appears that we are bracing ourselves for another one of these sagas again, and that was the tone of O'Neill's comments. So we'll talk about in a while maybe how much of this was driven from O'Neill's side and how much of it from Obafemi. The quotes leave room for interpretation. The Sun then, driven to despair, a play obviously on Glenn Whelan's Ferrari, Eamon Dunphy style history. Ferrari's not my wheels, says Glenn. So, drives into the international sunset, says Neil O'Riordan tonight, with a swipe at those who reckoned he was a write-off. So, the Star, back to It's Far From Oba, the Obafemi angle there. Paul Lennon again, not pressuring Ford, Southampton Ford, Obafemi about his international future. There's also something with Paul McGinley and Rory McIlroy as well on the back of the Star, baffled by Rory's decision he may not take up European Tour membership in 2019. I think McGinley posted a blog on the Sky Sports Golf blog, describing his move to not take up 2019 membership as quite extraordinary.
Really?
So, it's interesting.
I thought it was perfect. I thought it made perfect sense. I think in Rory's ideal world, he'll be saying to himself, I'd like to play the Irish Open, but realistically, the idea of actually getting my career back on track in terms of winning majors again, I need to be in America all the time, with the new calendar as well.
Yeah, see, the thing is, it's easy for... Rory has saved the Irish Open.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, I still think that the prospect of the tournaments come to Lahinch this year, or next year, you know, a real iconic, famous Irish course. Now, McIlroy had previously argued that he wanted, because Portrush is hosting the British Open next year, that he wanted Lahinch the week before. And he had he tried to get the European Tour to swap the Irish and the Scottish Opens next year. This was when Rory was still the tournament host. And it didn't happen. His move didn't go through. And now he's saying, well, I might want to play the week before. I still think PR-wise, skipping the Irish Open is not good. It's not a good look for Rory still. And I think there'll be a bit of bite back. And McGinley's obviously the tournament host of the Irish Open next year. So that is the context of McGinley's view being interesting, you know.
That is going to be an interesting political...
McGinley's also been critical of McIlroy a couple of times as well. So you do wonder
as
well.
Had a few swipes.
Yeah. And just finally, the mirror then, it hurt when it was personal. And again, it's Glenn Whelan on his personal issues with Eamon Dunphy, sorry. And again, Fulham turned to Ranieri after a snub from Wenger, just confirming that Arsene Wenger angle.
Good stuff. Let's get into some of those football talking points. But before that, we've got two pairs of tickets to give for tonight's game between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. They're right here. Just get in touch using the hashtag OTBTix. That's OTBTICS with your comments. And the best comment will get a pair of tickets. You just have to be able to come to our offices in Stephen's Green before the match to pick up those tickets. So as you can see, the breakfast menu, Oba Femi is top of the list. Whelan's Critics is up there as well. Mon versus Mon, that is of course the two managers ahead of tonight's game. Goodbye Rooney from an English perspective, and Gareth Southgate has had his say on quotas. Let's hear from Martin O'Neill. He's been speaking about Michael Oba Femi, and he says that he's not going to rush his decision.
I haven't spoken to his parents, but I have spoken to him, and I think that he's enjoyed the training. It's been really good. He's done very well as well, too. I think Glenn would agree with me. Very well in the training. He's settled in nicely. I think he's really enjoyed it. I think in terms of decisions for tying him down, I think that's a bit of a distance off. You know, I think he has got things to think about, like everything else, and I certainly would not be rushing him. And that was my point to him, you know. So, yeah, as I said to you, I think a couple of days ago, that if he come in, rushed in and said, yeah, this is exactly what I want to do, fine with it, then that's a different issue. But, you know, I want the people, obviously, to want to play for us for a start, and I want them to be right for the rest of their time.
So fair to say that he won't be going to Denmark then?
At this minute, unless we have heard anything to the contrary, no, he wouldn't do that.
Here we go again.
Yeah, our old friend, the eligibility saga. I don't know. Like, I'm sort of doing the Ireland beat now for like 12, 13 years. I don't know what we did before. I can't remember a time when there wasn't an eligibility saga. But there's definitely been one for sort of a consistent basis across the last sort of 5 years anyway. I mean, it has sort of overlapped with Martin O'Neill's time in the sense that I think it's probably a combination of things. I think with England's options dwindling due to the sort of increase in globalisation of the Premier League, that they've had to fight harder. The FA have definitely started to fight more for, you know, English-born players that they might have let slip and been a bit more casual about before. And also just the little tweaks to the rules that have been made in terms of like friendly matches not being binding anymore, and the sort of politics of being able to switch around to underage level. It's become a massive part of underage football now as well. Irish underage football is that players are, you know, I've gone in the last couple of months, I made this point earlier this week, I've been watching the Ireland under 17 side, under 19, a couple of games. You know, one guy I watched playing for Ireland under 17s played for Northern Ireland the following month. There was a guy playing for Ireland last week who played for England the previous month. Players just have this mindset now that they know the rules. They know that there is a certain permanency about certain aspects of it. And it's sort of become a bit of a cultural normal thing for even agents and even other nations to say, well, go and play for them and we'll have a look and see how you get on, and you might come back to us, whoever the us may be. And, you know, we can be, it's ironic to Ireland play Northern Ireland tonight because we've sometimes been the big fish in that relationship and used that to our advantage. But it's like the food chain, when it comes to certain other players, we are very much, we are the underling. You know?
Yeah, what is Martin O'Neill's thinking about this? Because you said there, like when you were going through the papers, you're questioning how much of this has been driven by Martin O'Neill. Like, what was the thinking behind bringing Michael Oba Femi into the squad this week?
Yeah, this is what I'm not really clear about. And I think there's definitely a debate to be had in terms of how this one's been handled, because I think actually overall, I think he's handled some of the eligibility things better than maybe a common view appears to be. I don't think he could have done much more with Declan Rice personally.
Sure.
I think he called him in to train the day after he made his Premier League debut, and he pretty much brought him into the Ireland squad when it was realistic to do so.
Yeah, and Rice has been on record saying that Martin O'Neill has given a very persuasive case.
I think it's massive after timing to start going back to the Moldova game and stuff like that. I mean, Ireland were trying to qualify for a World Cup and Rice hadn't played Premier League in the previous month, and I've said it before, Sean Maguire was brought on that night as the third sub to a huge ovation and response, and if he'd been cut aside, well, some guy who at the time wasn't that well known was brought in for 5 minutes, it would have been strange.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was expected. And also, I also believe that Rice, like Obafemi, would have known the rules as well. So, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. But in this particular one, I find it odd. He was named in the long list last week. Martin O'Neill was asked at the time about the rationale for naming Jimmy Dunn and Obafemi. Jimmy Dunn is the guy who Northern Ireland were trying to recruit, who's from Dundalk. Basically, Martin O'Neill's response was, well, that was part of my rationale, that the interest is in other countries. But he did say then, Tom Mowen, the Ireland under-19 manager, basically said to him there's nothing to be worried about with Obafemi. And it was more
with regards to Nigeria, though.
Well, I don't know.
Was that in general?
In general. No, in general, towards his commitment. And where this sort of first seed of doubt came was when Mark Hughes spoke on Friday. And Mark Hughes was asked about it at the Southampton Weekly press conference, and he said may not be that clear cut about his future, and left it open. So we now have the situation where on Monday he hadn't spoken to Obafemi yet. Again, the argument is maybe have this chat last week, right? Mm. But he hadn't spoken to Obafemi and said, I will speak to him before Wednesday to see how he feels about playing potentially in Denmark and tying himself down. And that's what came to yesterday. Question, well, what's the update on Obafemi? And he said, well, he hadn't spoken to his family like he'd intended to. He'd spoken to the young lad himself. And there was phrases used like, he hadn't given total commitment, to Ireland. But then Martin O'Neill very much would clarify and say, now, just to be clear, I didn't pressurise him either. I don't want someone playing one game and then being stuck further down the line. Now, I do think Nigeria is more of a player in this game than England at this stage anyway. But then there was a journalist in the press conference yesterday, towards the end of it, who I think it was from Pundit Arena, who tackled Martin O'Neill and said, no, I've spoken to someone who knows Obafemi, and he says he's definitely going to play.
Okay.
He definitely wants to play for Ireland. He is up for it. And then Martin O'Neill is like, well, you know more than me.
That's a really awkward situation.
Who did you speak to? And then obviously the other guy's there, well, I can't reveal my sources. And then there's a bit of a set two, and O'Neill's like, I'll bring you into the breakfast room now, and come on with us. You know more than me.
So, what's your gut feeling on what's going to happen?
I don't know. You see, in this one, I have less of a read on Obafemi than any of the others. Even when he wasn't in the Ireland under-19 squad, they had a couple of games, I think, against Wales last month. He wasn't there. And I actually got a bit paranoid, because now international football increases paranoia when someone misses with an injury or an illness. So I met some inquiries, and I was told he's sick. And I was like, oh, yeah, he's sick. Yeah. But then it turns out he just was sick. It wasn't a problem. Like, he's come in here this week to train. He's in Ireland at the moment, in the hotel, with the first team squad, with the management. I think, that is a big step. And I think if a player is willing to come across and do that, you have to take it as a positive.
Definitely.
And I think if the player, but then the flip side of that is, if a player has come to that, is coming that far and is coming in, it goes back to the culture of what players are able to do now. He must know that this is a big symbolic step to come and train with a senior squad. Now, what I don't agree with is that yesterday, when Martin O'Neill made the comments about him requiring more time, Obafemi starts getting all this abuse. This guy's taking us for a ride. It's a disgrace. And, probably tagging him in tweets and sort of insulting him. And that doesn't serve any purpose. He's done nothing wrong. He's done nothing wrong yet. With the Declan Rice thing, I still think the fact he played three times and stood for the anthem and gave it all that, it doesn't reflect well on him if he changes.
No.
It definitely doesn't.
And it's very different to the Obafemi.
As much as I understand the dilemma and the reason why it would be attractive, I think when you stand in front of the anthem and take a senior cap, taking a senior cap off someone else, but there is something in that as well.
For sure.
And you have to be careful in terms of how you play these things. And I would make this point. I don't agree. I didn't think the Rice Moldova thing made sense. I also am not mad on if Obafemi was sort of, well, maybe throwing him on for a minute against Denmark on Monday, like, that is, you, like, you're straddling a very fine line here, because there's going to be homegrown players or Irish-born players. I don't know, Obafemi's Irish-born, but obviously moved to England as a child, so his situation is a bit different anyway. Who, like, it's very insulting and demoralising for them, where effectively, and we've had this at under 21 level a bit too, where there's been like a fast tracking or promotion of guys. We need to get these guys in case we lose them. But like, what about the guys who, you know, they may also benefit from the opportunity to come in and train and be around the squad. And I know Lee O'Connor from Manchester United, who's the same age as Obafemi, he's been brought in this week, but specifically only to train. He's only listed as a training member. But still, generally, it's annoying a lot of people. This is alienating a lot of people. I've, you know, even yesterday, a lot of people are saying involved with League of Ireland and you know, making the point, what about Patrick Hooban? Should he not be invited around this week? Also, Aaron Connolly, a young Irish lad, Galway lad at Brighton, has been doing well at under 23 level. Why shouldn't he be around? And it's planting, I don't know, it's just leaving a slightly sour taste, the whole thing. And it's a delicate balancing act. And I have a small bit of sympathy with O'Neill because he's playing the game that everyone's playing.
Yeah, and we can see on screen here, Kevin tweeting, look, but you can't touch. Anyone else want to try a run? That's in relation to your tweet saying that Obafemi wants more time to think about his international future. I would be interested to see what the reaction to this particular situation would be. It's a Declan Rice situation, never existed at all. That everybody's like, oh, here we go again. And to be fair, I just said that 5 minutes ago. But like, that is the way around it. As an individual case, I'm not sure there's actually too much blame to go around. We would love to hear your thoughts. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. I'm sure there's a lot of polarising views. Before we get to Darren and the first part of our David Gillick interview, we do want to chat about Glenn Whelan. The quotes have been drawn right back up this week. He's a terrible player. He can't run. He can't pass. He can't tackle. He doesn't see anything. He drives two Ferraris. I think he's a very lucky lad. Have 50 caps for Ireland. Eamon Dunphy, 2013. Glenn Whelan hasn't done any media since, yesterday.
No, well, he hadn't done any media before then. He hadn't done his last formal sit down in front of the Irish press was at Euro 2012 in Gdynia before the opening game. And since then, he might have stopped once or twice after the match, but pretty much straight on, doesn't talk. Doesn't want to engage, and yet you would speak to actually Nathan and some of the lads who would have gone over from here to Premier League games more often would say that he would stop and be very pretty engaging with the locals in Stoke. It was very much an Irish thing. Didn't want to speak to Irish press. I think his view was, I don't want to sort of misrepresent it, but I think it seems to have come out that you know, he definitely did not like, obviously, Eamon Dunphy and some of the comments. And maybe with the rest of the Irish press, his issue was more so that they didn't defend him more against this, rather than that the press were also hammering too. Now, it was interesting when he was brought out yesterday, because you're wondering, what's he going to be like? You know, is he going to be... He was definitely brought there on sufferance.
What was he like?
I actually thought he spoke very well. As ever, some of these lads that haven't... they don't speak, they're actually... There's a lot of depth and interest because we haven't heard from them in so long. And he was pretty much... You know, he was throwing a bit of a use right the headlines. You know, I didn't take it personally. My family took it personally. People close to me took it personally. I was fine with it. No problem. I have no issue with any grief. I'd say he possibly did have a small issue with some
like
of the grief.
Pretty bad stuff to be saying about any football player. Yeah. Which I'm sure like his own professional pride took a huge hit after hearing that stuff.
Well, I would say like Glenn Whelan is like his 85th cap tonight. The most capped Irish midfielder of all time. That comment sort of provokes a bit of a snigger in some quarters because, like, well, Jesus, you know, Glenn Whelan. And his name almost is synonymous with old Glenn Whelan.
Yeah.
But, like, to me, Glenn Whelan is, you know, he's a Dublin lad who went down from Man City, you know, was released by Man City and has, like, fought his way up to the top, you know, to the top of the game in the sense of playing in the Premier League and having a long, established career in a tough game, in a tough industry, and he survived. And you speak to people who know him, like, sort of solid character to say. He's a great fella in the dressing room, you know, works hard, sort of no bullshit about him. And he probably is like a player that should be more of a role model in terms of his approach to his trade. So for him to be roundly derided for that, for a large period of his career. It must hurt. Like, it has to hurt.
And it's unfair. It is unfair, really, to be honest, when you look at the criticism of Glenn Whelan and kind of the things that have been written about him, not just there, but like the depth of the character, as you said, the way he was so interesting yesterday, the fact that he started his coaching badges. He's a fellow that we should probably be clinging on to in terms of the future of Irish football as well. We do have to leave Glenn Whelan there just for the moment. We will come back to that, and there's plenty more on the Breakfast Menu to come later on in the show. But David Gillick's new book is called Back on Track, and it focuses on how to achieve your diet, fitness and happiness goals. It features a bunch of delicious and simple recipes. He cooked us some eggs and showed us how to make an energy-packed breakfast smoothie. Have a look at this. All right, Back on Track is David Gillick's brand new book. It's out now in all good bookstores. David, how are you?
I'm good.
Thank you very much for inviting us into your home and into your kitchen, most importantly.
No problem.
You're going to cook us up a few things this morning for our breakfast audience.
I am.
And for hungry bellies in the morning.
Yeah, I am. Going to keep it fairly simple. It's recipes from the new book. And again, it's just keeping things really straightforward, practical, that everyone of all walks of life can kind of just try it out.
So what are we going to have?
So we're going to do baked eggs. So really straightforward again, tomato base, crack an egg, bit of creme fraiche, bit of cheese, salt and pepper, bang it in the oven for a couple of minutes and it's done. And then also going to do kind of a smoothie, but I'm not going to use milk, not going to use a juice, going to use a tea. And I'm going to put a bit of nut butter in there, a bit of frozen berries and a bit of cinnamon.
That sounds really good. Yeah. So we may as well get cracking and see how you do this.
Okay, alright. So first thing I'm going to do here is I've got some ramekins. So I'll just grease them with a little bit of butter, okay, just so it doesn't all stick to it. And what I do quite a lot now is I make my own tomato bases. So again, you're looking at really kind of simple, 3 tins of plum tomatoes, a little bit of butter and onion, and just let that stew for a while, about 40 minutes, and then you can blend it together. And you get a great tomato sauce that you can use in a whole variety of dishes. So for the baked eggs, just gonna spoon that straight in, a little bit extra. So all you wanna do is kind of like just coat the end of it. When you bake an egg, it can dry out a little bit. Mm. So it's important just to kind of keep that nice and moist, if you like. Okay, so if you want to grab an egg there as well, you can help me out on this one. You're going to do, don't mess this up now, okay? We don't want any shell in here.
This is actually that most high pressure environment I've ever been in.
All right, just crack the egg straight in. That's all your eggs in. Now you can get a little bit of salt and pepper. So if you grab the salt's in this one here, and just pinch the salt in, I'll do a little bit of pepper. Easy peasy.
This is personal best stuff. This is PB, is right. This is, I've never pinched salt so quick.
Okay, and then some creme fraiche. A little bit of top of that straight in. So again, this is just nice when it's kind of stays moist and a little bit wet as well.
The first thing that really sticks out to me here is just how easy this is.
Yeah, well again, like I'm not, like to be honest with you, I'm like on flash. not as flash as I'd like, but in the kitchen, just keep it nice and simple. Again, busy with family, we've got 2 kids here, my wife works full time, so this would be something that we'd probably do as a brunch on the weekends and things like that, you know. And again, the more ramekins you have, you can do it in a big dish as well. So if you're having people around, you guys are very lucky. We're only in this house not that long, so you're the first people we're having in for some breakfast. And just put some little cheese on top. Cheese in, and that is it. It's all prepped.
There you go, ideal.
Alright, so we're going to bang that into the oven for about 10 minutes.
So you want to talk us through this. We've got a tea here, which isn't traditionally, we're saying.
No, so again, when it comes to smoothies, a lot of people would use like milk or a milk alternative or a fruit juice or something like that. So I'd be kind of, and it was probably just been an athlete and stuff like that, you know, the green tea was a big buzzword for a while, and then you get stuck into green tea, then it was mint tea, then it was berry tea. But if you let the berry tea cool down, you know, it's fruity, it tastes good. Use that as your base liquid, so you're not kind of, you're cutting back on sugars and stuff like that.
Right.
So again, really simply, all I'm going to do is now, I've let that kind of brew a little bit, so getting all the flavour out of the tea bag, and all I'm going to do is just pour that straight in. Okay. Alright, so next thing I'm going to put in is just some frozen berries. So these are just frozen raspberries. So I'll just use that spoon, and again, adds a good bit of flavour to it. Antioxidants and all that kind of healthiness in there as well. So a few of those go in. So next thing I'm going to put in is some nut butter. So this one's peanut butter. Again, you can use almond butter, anything you kind of want. So I get a good spoon of that in.
So you're going with about 2.5 tablespoons there.
Yeah, a little bit, 2.5 there. There's probably about 250 ml, standardized cup of tea, mug of tea, a couple of spoonfuls of berries. All right, and then just a little bit of cinnamon in there as well, good for during out the winter and all that. Now I'm going to use the Nutribullet. So put a lid on that. Okay, and just going to go straight on. And that is it.
There you go, just like that.
All right, just like that. I'll get a glass here behind you. Can have a little bit of a taste.
So you have a special name for whatever this is, but what is the
cocktail?
We've got to give it a name.
You give it a name.
Well, first of all, it's absolutely delicious.
Oh, that's good. He's all right. He can come back.
It's really strange. I'm not sure. Is this not the norm to actually put fruit in with peanut butter? But it's certainly the first time I've actually kind of ventured down this incredibly healthy path. And it's really good.
Probably could have done a little bit more on with the berries. And also, actually, I forgot to put in my honey.
It's key component.
A little bit of sweetness required, I think. Yeah, it's all right.
It's more than all right. It's a solid 10 out of 10.
I got nervous with you here in my kitchen, you know.
Well, yeah, so I can see the nervousness here, but I think under all the constraints of said nerves, I think you did a fantastic job.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Sometimes people are always like, oh, I don't have time to, you know, eat well or make certain changes. But again, simple little things like that, even preparing something the night before, can just kind of get you out of the hole in the morning time and just kick the day off in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. I think we should call it the starting block or something
like that. The starting block. The starting block. Yeah, like yeah.
Just thinking rapidly for the last 5 minutes of any of the next ones.
No, but that's it. It's kind of just teeing it all up and, you know, something like that, bring it with you. Like the Nutribullet smoothies, stuff like that, are a great thing to have as well because you can add so much into it. And it's just using what you have. You know, just keep it simple. Breakfast time, throw in your oats in there, good form of energy, and over the course of the day, kicks it all.
Nice one, well, it's delicious, fair play.
Yeah, nice one.
We will see how those eggs turned out and hear David's story of being diagnosed with depression and how he got things back on track and the role nutrition played in that journey a little bit later on in the show. If anybody else is up for us calling out to their house for terrible puns, but actual good nutrition, we're accepting invites, basically. Darren Cleary, how are you?
The starting block.
It's the best thing I ever said. I saw the viewers dip immediately after I said that.
you were definitely hoovering that into you before you left as well. You were just sort of you took the first nervous sip like someone taking wine, and you had to sort of say, "Oh yeah, that's fine." But then you sort of just
I took out the hip flask, put in a whiskey, and then down the rest of it. It was delicious. Then
he grew into the glass anyway as it went on.
100%.
Even without the honey, it was okay, or were you just trying to be a good guest?
No, without the honey, it was actually really nice. But maybe I'm just not used to actually drinking wholesome things, and maybe he's just kind of awakened me to this whole new reality that actually you can make really cool smoothies in your own house and they're actually healthy for you.
Good for the career too, Owen, when you audition for Ireland AM. You've got that whole cooking and lifestyle thing down.
Well, as we were saying, we were supposed to have David Gellick in studio here, but health and safety dictated that we couldn't do it. We could have had everybody in here with his hot plates and everything, but that's probably something for the future. What's going on?
Martin O'Neill, he says that he fears that there are more eligibility sagas to come unless FIFA make changes to the rules. Since taking over from Giovanni Trapattoni, O'Neill has faced a tug of war with the English FA over Jack Grealish and Declan Rice, while Michael Obafemi is the latest player to ask for time to consider his options amid interest from England and Nigeria. The Dubliner is set to skip Monday's competitive Nations League game in Denmark, as involvement in that would tie him to Ireland for the rest of his career. This is what Martin O'Neill said yesterday when asked if changes are needed to the rules surrounding eligibility.
I would tell FIFA that they would have to cap Declan Rice immediately, you know. So, you know, it's going to be there. Listen, if they did, you know, and as I said now, having experienced now that situation just recently, and I suppose the first time I came across it would be with Jack Grealish. I think it's something you'd look at. They may well, as I said, easily put me in my place and say, these are the rules, these are fine and too bad, and you just have to deal with them. And I probably would abide with it, but I would need to go into it a wee bit more deeply now rather than giving some convoluted version here where I would end up contradicting myself after, you know, 3 or 4 sentences or something like that there. But at this minute, the way I'd look at it, it's definitely something that is going to rear its head more often than not.
I wonder, is there a double standard there in the Declan Rice Obafemi thing? Like he says at the very start of that clip, well, people were saying I should have capped Declan Rice a lot sooner. Like, I do wonder if that was literally his intention, that it was like, I'm not going to make this mistake ever again, and I don't care what anybody thinks about me.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny, when the Declan Rice-Moldova thing was mentioned to him last week, it was in a daily section, he was genuinely shocked. He was like, what? Moldova game? He hadn't crossed his mind at all at that stage. Definitely hadn't crossed his mind at all. I do think he is probably reacting to it now, and I think if Obafemi had suggested this week he was totally on board, I think he probably would have tried to throw him on at some stage on Monday in Denmark. Which goes to show, it sort of backs up his point in some ways, that the players do know the rules and they know what they can do. And as I said, there's no guarantee that if Declan Rice had been called in for the Moldova squad that he would have said that, I wouldn't have brought forward the decision that he ultimately took. You can't say that with certainty.
No.
So, particularly now, like after like the every young, like the problem with the Rice thing is he went so far, I've said this, that every young English-born kid or overseas-born kid playing for Ireland now is facing this question from the first time they walk into a camp. Like under 17, under 16, they all know that when they play senior level, they can't just be sort of coerced into it. They know the boundaries and what they can do.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't entrap a player to play for Ireland if you want to. Like the first time Rice was called in even to train with the squad, I think it was before the Austria game. And we had six competitive games in between the Austria game and when he said no initially to the first competitive game of actually taking the cap. So it wouldn't be a good look to go and try and not just coerce players but force them their hand and entrap them into playing for a national team if they're not so sure. Dual nationality, I'm lucky, my parents are Irish, I don't have those conflicting views. But for all intents and purposes, Declan Rice is English, he grew up in England, he's from England, his social circle would be English, but then again his parents are as Irish come. So it's a very, very difficult to force yourself to tie yourself to one nationality when you have feelings and an affinity for two different countries.
Yes,
so I don't envy the guy.
No, definitely. I should mention as well while we're talking about Ireland that we still have these tickets going for Republic of Ireland against Northern Ireland tonight. Hashtag OTBTICS, that's T-I-C-S, on social media, and the best comments will win a pair of tickets.
Bit of a blow for Manchester City defender Benjamin Mendy is facing a spell on the sidelines. He's had an operation on his left knee. The fullback missed 7 months of City's Premier League winning campaign. Last season, he ruptured the cruciate ligament in his right knee. No timescale has been given on the 24-year-old's return to action. Mendy has made 12 appearances this season and played the full 90 in Sunday's 3-1 derby victory over Manchester United. He did joke on Twitter that his other knee was feeling a bit left out, so that's why he decided to get that one tidied up. In rugby, Rob Kearney and Devon Toner could be recalled to the Ireland team for Saturday's test against New Zealand at the Aviva Stadium. Dan Levy tipped to replace the injured Sean O'Brien in the back row. The coach is facing a bit of a conundrum at centre. Robbie Henshaw ruled out. Gary Ringrose, Bundy Aki, Carrie Knox. Will Addison could be called upon once again. Defence coach Andy Farrell says the Ulster back is more than reliable.
To go from just bringing your boots in and hoping there's a chance to actually being thrown into the deep end against a really good side in Argentina and playing like he did, and try to get on the ball as much as you can and get involved, and his involvements were great. I can't speak highly enough of one, his professionalism to be able to do that and fit into the side, but two, the guts to actually get a hold of the game himself and give it a real shake.
We're due to get the Irish team news just before 2 o'clock. They're up early in New Zealand. They have revealed their starting 15 to face Ireland. Ryan Crotty, the only change to the All Black side that started against England in that narrow 1-point win. New Zealand coach Steve Hansen has named pretty much his strongest available team for the clash on Saturday. The All Blacks in Ireland have played 30 times in Test rugby, 28 wins for them, 1 to Ireland and 1 draw in that time. In Gaelic games, Dublin looks set to maintain home advantage for 2 games in the Super 8s next season. The Irish Independent report that the GAA's Central Competitions Control Committee are unlikely to change the arrangements that give Dublin home advantage for Croke Park, as well as playing their neutral venue game on Jones's Road. A document dispatched to counties yesterday said, since the introduction of the qualifiers in 2001, Croke Park has been considered a neutral venue for quarterfinals, including games involving Dublin. Fixtures there have generally been welcomed by players above games in any other venue. It notes that deciding on Croke Park status as a neutral venue is a matter for the GAA's Congress.
Everything is a matter for the GAA's Congress. If you have the option of common sense, they will always come up with, on the other hand, we could go to Congress and see what actually might happen there.
I think they're bound by the rule book when it suits them, but we saw with the common sense approach to the Porky Queeve and Liam Miller thing that sometimes the rules allow you for loopholes, and the rules there very much did. It allowed for an event that is not in contradiction with the GAA's aims and values, and they could absolutely find a way of getting around the fact that Croke Park is a neutral venue by looking at it in a common sense approach and say it is not neutral if it happens to be in Dublin. The GAA have described it as an anomaly that Croke Park is in Dublin. It's such a bizarre word.
It's funny how those things happen, isn't it? You know?
Like, it's a pretty easy fix. There's a way around it. Move Dublin's home game to somewhere else in Leinster.
Yeah.
Or let them play their home game in Croke Park and move the neutral venue to somewhere that's actually neutral. Maybe somewhere in between where the counties they're facing in between there.
And everybody would be a winner from this. You look at Dublin's best game in the Super 8s this year, and it was the one that didn't happen in Croke Park.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
That's because Sky narrowed the pitch, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's true. Actually, we did have that other storyline surrounding that game. Like, we'll probably be having this conversation next July when nothing is done about this. But hopefully somebody will be able to push this through and actually awaken Congress to the idea that, you know, maybe Croke Park is Dublin's home ground.
Yeah, it's an anomaly own. We don't know what to do with anomalies, yeah. So let's send it to Congress. Paul McGinley says he cannot understand why Rory McIlroy is playing just two European Tour events next season. A story you've touched on already today, Owen, but McIlroy must play at least four European Tour tournaments outside majors and WGC events to retain membership. He currently only has two on his schedule. He could even miss the Irish Open, an event he has hosted for the last 4 years. McGinley, in his blog for Sky Sports, said, "It's very disappointing, obviously a blow for the European Tour. I've been racking my brains wondering how that can be. Obviously Rory sees it in other ways and he's got his own rationale for that, although I'm finding it hard to understand." Well, Shane Lowry, Paul Dunne among the early starters at the DP World Tour Championship in Dubai on 200 par. Dunne just a shot off the lead, held by four players at the moment, 300. Lowry a shot further back, while the Irish cricket team continue their quest for a first win at the Women's 2020 World Cup today after defeats to Australia and Pakistan. Ireland take on India.
Right, thanks for that, Darren. We're going to pick things up with David Gillick. He spoke to us about his new book, Back on Track. We've already seen at the cooking segment, but we also sat down with him for an in-depth interview after that. So he's been very open about his experience of depression, and this piece contains a conversation about dealing with suicidal thoughts. If you're affected by any issues in this video, you can contact the Samaritan's 24-hour free phone helpline at 116 123. Here's our chat with David. All right, so these beauties have come out of the oven. They look and they smell absolutely amazing. But David, we're going to play a game of egg Russian roulette here, because I didn't tell you that I did get a bit of eggshell in this about 10 minutes
ago.
Well,
I'm going to be honest with you, so did I.
So we look forward to our cheese and eggshell and tomato sauce. It does smell amazing, and we're going to dig right in because these are going to get cold, but they look sensational. Hot. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty damn good, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, they're good. They're one of my favourite now.
The eggshell really adds to it as well. It's absolutely...
Yeah, you got killer. One, did you?
It's a secret ingredient.
Well, you put half the shell in there, so
So talk to us about when you're making this sort of stuff. Is this something you've always been interested in when you were running? Was it like, I've got to prepare everything to a tee, and if it's nice and creative like this, then added bonus?
Yeah, I think it all started for me when I moved out of home. So mum would have done all the cooking, and then when I found myself over in the UK in Loughborough, I was going to shops, buying the food, and then cooking it. So from that perspective, I began to kind of look after a little bit more about what I was eating, more of an interest about it. I wanted to better my performance, so I started working with nutritionists and people like that. So I began to get kind of an insight from a performance point of view. And then the two of them just kind of coincided, you know. It got to a point where I actually quite enjoyed cooking, because I found it a little bit therapeutic. You know, in the evening time, you come in from a day's training. You know, when you get into the kitchen, then I wasn't analysing what I was kind of, my times in training or my next race. You're just literally focused on what you're doing, you know. So I actually kind of found it a bit of an outlet. And then from that perspective, I just kind of got more into it and really enjoyed cooking and kind of looking from kind of the healthy side of it as well as the performance side of it. At the end of the day, I wanted to kind of better myself, and food was part of that.
I do wonder if people who are kind of stuck in an office all day, they go out for a run in the evening, you've been out running all day, you come into the kitchen in the evening, and that's your sort of version of going for a jog.
Yeah. Well, you're engrossed in it, and everything you do, like everything at that level was all about trying to get around that track as fast as I possibly could. So, you know, you're out of bed in the morning time, it's going train, you're back lunch, you're back training. So, you know, you need something to switch off. And I think sometimes as well, when you're in the kitchen, well, for me anyway, I was by myself in the kitchen. So I was around people all day talking about athletics, like, you know, so it was nice to get to a stage of the day where you didn't need to kind of talk about it. You could just literally switch off.
Yeah. When you went abroad and you saw athletes from all over the world, was their nutrition at a similar level to you? Were you a level above them?
No, I think I actually was a bit of a level above. I can remember finishing training sessions over in England, and I'd have like a recovery shake. So again, protein, carbohydrates, And I'd be necking that, and people would be like, oh, what's in that? And I'd be thinking, what do you mean, what's in that? It's a recovery shake. And a lot of people didn't. They didn't put a value on it. They kind of knew about it, but probably didn't make it part of their routine, you know. And then even some international athletes, I can remember racing in a Diamond League in New York, and two American athletes, we went training, say, the day before, and we were coming back from training, and the bus stopped at lights, traffic lights. The two lads hopped out straight into McDonald's. This was like 2 days or a day before a race. And I can remember thinking, oh, that's a bit, you know, mad. And obviously you hear the stories of like your Usain Bolt eating chicken nuggets. But I think my best is my training partner and good mate, Martin Rooney. You know, Martin was, well, he was sixth in the Beijing Olympics, like as a junior, around 44 seconds. Double European champion, you know, really bigging this up here, but he was a good athlete and is a good athlete, still running. But I would have trained and travelled with Rooney for years, and I always remember we were over in America one time, and we were sharing a room, two single beds, and I was very much in bed, you know, earplugs in and going to sleep, get me rest. And I could hear this kind of noise, you know, what is he doing? And look over, and there he was playing, this is probably like midnight, playing his PSP. And then every kind of couple of minutes there was a rumble, like a little rustle, and I'd look over and there he was playing the PSP eating Skittles. And he was picking the Skittles out of what looked like a raisin box. And what he had done was, because we were living with my coach Nick, so when we got there, Rooney straight to the shops, bought a kg of raisins, chucked all the raisins in the bin, and then replace them all with Skittles.
That's
so
amazing.
So he'd be walking around going, how are you, Nick? And he'd be eating Skittles. Like.
And was that a regular part of his nutrition?
Yeah, it was. It was. And even later on, about a year or so later, we were over in LA again. And one of the first kind of big collegiate meets over there is the Mount Sac Relays. So it's always a good quality race. And Rooney got up the morning of. I was injured, so I wasn't going anywhere. Rooney got up, had Frosties, or the equivalent of Frosties. Off he went, and we watched it. It was streamed online. We watched it, and his first race of the season ran 44.9. And I remember looking at Graeme, my training partner, going, and we were eating a porridge. We're like, porridge, give me that Skittles, or give me the Frosties, you know. But it, look, it's very individual, I think, I suppose. And there is an element of, like, kind of placebo effect to it as well. But, you know, you can't deny that food does add value to your performance. But, you know, I think when I look back now, probably a bit of balance in there would be a good thing.
Yeah, because we can call it a placebo effect, but the idea of happiness is a very real thing. And if that bottle of Skittles, or if Usain Bolt's chicken nuggets or Michael Phelps pizza or McDonald's or whatever he has is helping him derive some sort of happiness from his day-to-day routine, then that's going to aid performance. A happy athlete is probably a better athlete.
It is, and I think it comes down to consistency as well. I think, you know, if you're eating Skittles every meal, every day of the week, well then, yeah, you're probably going to have problems somewhere along the way. So again, it comes down to, like, just, you know, your base meals, your consistency of eating good quality food, like your training. You know what I mean? It's consistency of training that's going to win you medals. You know, it's not your one-off good sessions. So there has to be a bit of balance. But I do kind of agree as well. Like, you know, if it puts a smile on your face, it can't be that bad.
Yeah. I do want to read out the subtitle on the book, Back on Track. Yeah. It says, Eat, Move, Think, and Rest Your Way to Your Happiest, Healthiest Self. So this isn't just a cookbook. This is not just what you should eat. This is a book explaining why you should eat the things you eat.
Yeah, like I after my first book, David Gill's Kitchen, which was just solely a cookbook off the back of MasterChef, like I to be honest with you, wasn't really looking at doing another book, but the publisher Gill came to me and were like, look, you know, we're really interested, etc, etc, and I thought about it, and then I was like, you know what, I'd like to do something a little bit different. Obviously, yes, it is a cookbook, but I wanted to kind of showcase my journey over the last couple of years as to why I have an interest in food and the benefits, not only for me, but I suppose for my family, you know. And that's kind of what I really want to showcase in terms of, like, the mental approach to it, the element of exercise and the element of rest. Because I think that, like, everyone's, you know, you hear the word of kind of well-being and, you know, looking after yourself, healthy lifestyle. But I think, you know, food is part of that as well as the other elements. And I wanted to kind of showcase some of the little things, the strategies, the tips, the advice that I received over the last number of years, and just kind of maybe help other people out there.
Yeah, because when I mentioned a few moments ago that your kitchen might be somebody else's jogging, like, I'm kind of facetious when I say that, but there's a serious point there, really. Yeah. It is the idea that, as you mentioned there, you were a professional athlete surrounded by people who were thinking about this singular end game constantly. That's not good for anybody's mental health.
No, and I'll be honest, I can look back at my career now and, you know, like if you can imagine like three circles, Okay, so I would have had my athletics career, you know, for post athletics, and then social, you know, and ideally you want to be in the middle. Everyone's kind of intertwined. I was very much in my athletics. Everything I did from social to, I didn't even look at career because I was like, I was an athlete.
That was your career.
That was it. That was my everything. Suddenly that went, you know, and then what? So all my confidence, my self-esteem, my self-worth came from a training session, a performance, a championship. The minute that was gone, I didn't know where I was. You know, like I didn't have a goal, didn't have a purpose, my identity. And if you look at like stats around mental health, particularly male mental health, your identity is very, very closely linked to your job. You know, so if your job's gone, that's where people kind of, you know, can run into problems. And I found myself in that situation where I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what interests I had. I didn't know what hobbies I had, because everything for the last maybe 12 years was all around my athletics.
Did you have anybody around you at the time who could identify that that was going to become an issue, this one-dimensional view of life? Or were they so focused on you being the best you could be on the track? So, to be honest, they didn't really care about anything else.
Yeah, there's an element of that. Like, you know, a lot of people that I surrounded myself with were athletes. A lot of kind of, let's say, adults or older people were coaches, or they were, you know, performance service providers, you know. And I think I was living in that world. And, you know, that's where kind of my social, I probably wasn't tapping into the friends I grew up with. You know, I was living abroad as well. But, you know, I wasn't tapping into the lads who knew me as David Gillick, not David Gillick, the athlete. And likewise with family as well. Sometimes it can be very awkward, because anytime you come home or there's a family event, it's all about like, oh, David, you know, when's your next race and how's training going? You know, it's not like just common chat, you know. And I think I probably disengaged from that. I would have pulled back from friends. I would have pulled back from family, because I didn't want the questions. So therefore then, yeah, it goes back to that circle. I was just staying within my comfort zone. And nobody really said, like, you're going to run into problems. But again, everyone's invested. And I think that's something, the way things have gone now, it's all performance-based. So a lot of the sports in Ireland, their funding is dictated by how they do at a Worlds or an Olympics. So you can see it's all about performance. It's not really about the human being, or it's not really about where will that human being be in 10 years, post-career. Now, things are kind of changing. There is good people. I know over in the Institute, Owen Reinisch, a former Olympian, and another guy, Niall O'Donoghue, who are really trying to create links between sport and industry and education, to try and give athletes, up-and-coming athletes who are carded and are going for, say, Tokyo and beyond, that like they have outlets along the way. They have other interests. They have hobbies. They can get in and do internships. They can do work experience. They can also keep in the education as they go over the years, because I think that's vitally important.
Yeah. From what you say there, it seems that the idea of being an athlete would actually hammer home any seeds of problems that you might have mentally, because you could compare it to any other career, really, but say if you're sitting at a desk job, if you're working for a company or something like that, there are different strands to your job. Mm-hmm. Whereas as an athlete, particularly in your case, for two reasons. First of all, it's a solo sport.
Yeah.
Second of all, the training, I'd imagine, maybe it's not overly repetitive. You can come up with creative ways of training, but ultimately the process is running 400 meters.
Yeah.
And it is quite a black and white thing.
It's a very black and white thing. And I think, you know, to be fair, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's very much monotonous. You know, it is a little bit like Groundhog Day. You know, I won't lie, 11 months of the year, you're training, and then you go again for another 11 months of the year. And yeah, your outlets, you don't really have a whole lot, because you're very much, and you're so driven as well. Like, that's the other thing as well. Like, you know, you're very passionate, determined, and you've always got a championship. You know, every year you've got a championship to work towards. And, you know, even in a 4-year cycle, that's what your aim is. That's where you want to go. So I think in terms of like, you or me as an individual at the time, it was about trying to get around that track as fast as possible. That's all that mattered in my world.
And how many years could your mind sustain that for? At what point did you realize you were running into problems?
Well, it's a great question, because I think I probably learned a lot about myself post-career going to counselling. And I can remember, like, after 2 or 3 sessions with the counsellor, I remember kind of thinking, God, why didn't I do this years ago? Because you mentioned something there previously about, like, you know, I do think there was elements of a kind of my mental health, or, you know, the problems that might come down the road with my mental health probably came to the fore during my career. But a performance suddenly changes everything, or a training session changes everything. So you think it's okay. You think it's all fine. Like, you know, there's times when I, you know, my self-talk would have been very negative, or, you know, I'm trying to kind of fit in with the training group and make sure that I was doing things to to other people as opposed to myself, you know, making sure that I was kind of keeping up with the Joneses, let's say, as opposed to kind of listening to my own gut feeling. And should I make this decision? Is that the right move for me? But I was probably listening to a coach or listening to somebody else, looking for somebody else to lead me, as opposed to kind of just trusting my own instinct and trusting myself, even my own talents. Actually remind yourself that you're pretty good at what you do, you know. And I think that's something that sports people are either good at or they can struggle at, you know, because we live in a world where we want more. We always want more. And I think sometimes in terms of athletics, it's either a distance or it's a time. So like even you're always, yeah, it's good, but I need to get more. I need to get more. And you forget about actually, you know, you're pretty good at what you do.
Yeah, it sounds like your relationship with success was at that time the most important thing in your life. So yeah. When you had a particularly good run or event or you had a particularly good day, you would get the endorphin rush. You would... Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to ask is, was that idea of happiness an illusion?
Yeah.
For those brief moments after a good performance.
Yeah, yeah. Like I think when you put it that way, there's an argument to say it was. Yeah, I think that's what all my success, my confidence, my self-esteem all came from, was a performance. And if you had one performance, you had a good performance, that would give you like a shot, if you like, for the next kind of maybe weeks and months. And then that became the obsession. That became the drug. You know, I was very fortunate to win the Europeans and do a lap of honour, stuff that I dreamt of as a kid. That became my drug or my goal for the next couple of years. And, you know, yeah, okay, your goals can change and things like that. But I think that, yeah, I think there is an argument to say that, like, that's a superficial sort of way of looking at happiness across all aspects of your life, you know. Mm. And that's where I think I put too much emphasis on that. And when that was gone, that's when I thought when I retired, I'll just, you know, I thought transition-wise, it'll all be fine, you know, something will come up, you know, people talk about this void, this emptiness, you'll feel it, you know. I thought I could, I thought it would just, something else would come along. But it didn't, and it didn't for a while. And I think that kind of really kind of stood out to me as, you know, all my success, my happiness came from a race.
How long after you retired did it take for you to figure out a way to actually maintain some sort of consistent happiness?
Yeah, about 3 years.
Right.
Yeah, about 3 years. You know, I tried different things. I went back and played a little bit of sport, played GAA with Ballantyre. You know, then I got a job, got married. All of these kind of big things in life, you know. I hope my wife's not listening, but like, not that I wasn't happy on my wedding day. I was, and I was very happy with Charlotte, and I still am. But you kind of think, like, you know, think you do all these things and things will just kind of work itself out a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think late 2015 was when it just wasn't getting any better. You know, it just wasn't. And I think that's when I really began to kind of struggle. But in a good way, I also kind of realized I needed help. You know, but 3 years, I wasn't talking to anyone. I completely disengaged from friends, family. I was now living back in Dublin, but I wasn't going out. I wasn't talking to people. One, I didn't want the questions, mainly because I didn't know the answers.
Mm.
So I'd be telling lies the whole time. I used to worry an awful lot about the future. You know, I didn't know where I was going to be in 5 years, 10 years. How am I going to pay the bills? You know, what am I going to do? You know, and then you'd instantly kind of look back at your career and kind of, you know, idolize that person that used to run. I couldn't believe that was me. But then I resented it. I actually resented my athletic career because it put me in the situation I am now. So instantly, you know, that internal dialogue becomes quite negative and you start kind of going, well, if I didn't run, well, then I wouldn't be in the situation. You know, so, you know, in terms of looking back at any successes, pictures, medals, anything that, wouldn't do it.
Late 2015, you say you come to that realization. Was there a particular moment, or was it just kind of a building up of emotion in your own mind?
It was a building up over a period of time, but it did come to a head on a Sunday because I hated Sundays. I dreaded the week, you know.
Because of the week ahead. So
the week ahead, yeah. I used to kind of firefight to Friday. Saturday, I was okay. Saturday was kind of like, you know, it's a relaxed day. Everyone's relaxed. And then Sunday, the minute Sunday came around.
And what would you have planned on a Monday?
Well, at this moment of time, I was working full time.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was working full time. So when I initially retired, I took a job, like within 2 weeks, panicked. I needed a job. Took a job, lasted in that job a year, and then moved on to something else. So that was it. It was just Monday again, kicking it all off, and I wasn't happy. So that's when I kind of realized, you know what, like, I'm doing a job here and I'm not happy, so I'm going to do no job and see if that's any better. But it coincided with, I decided in January 2016 that I needed to talk, I needed to go to a counsellor, or I needed someone. At the time, I didn't know who, but I actually rang a friend who had a similar background, and to be fair, he's on the back of the book. It's Richie Sadler. Richie's from Ballantyre. So rang Richie and he says, come on down for a cup of tea. So he lives locally, went down, had a cup of tea. This was the first time that I'd been honest with anyone and been honest with myself and just said all these things, all the stuff that was in my head, the negative thoughts and, you know, the scary thoughts. And at this point as well, like, Charlotte was 8 months pregnant on her first child, Oscar. And like, she's in tears, because I think when it comes to mental health, she was my wife. She felt she was the person that should be able to fix me. Mm. But she's too emotionally connected to me. You know, so she'd be, you know, if I say anything and if she said, oh, try this, I would lose the head. You know what I mean? Because yeah. You take it all out on the person that matters most to you. So that was really frustrating for her. And I can remember she broke down the kitchen table. I remember thinking, God, I can't bring a child into this world if I'm not right. So I went, had a chat with Richie, and then through that, started counselling in January 2016. Best thing I've ever done.
I'd imagine. Like, it's interesting you mentioned scary thoughts and negative thoughts there. I do wonder if there's a difference. The negative thoughts you've kind of spoken about already, being quite hard on yourself as an athlete and resenting the fact that you had a career that put you in this position. What were the scary thoughts?
Yeah, I'll be honest. The scary thoughts were taking my own life. Yeah. Like, there was numerous occasions, you know, through the job I was doing, I was spending an awful lot of time by myself. Driving the length and breadth of this country. And, you know, I used to drive for probably 6 hours in a day. And I wouldn't listen to any radio, no offense, no music. It was literally Radio Gaelic. This voice inside my head that was just going over and over and over, and berating myself, telling me everything from, like, you know, you shouldn't have retired, or, you know, why did you ever run, or, you know, you should be doing this with your life. And even like little things like social media, you might see something that another sports person's doing and then you'd berate yourself because you'd compare. So this was going on for, like, that was the negative. That was the constant, you know, giving out to myself. And then, you know, you get so frustrated that, you know, there was times when I'd driving along, right, turn the wheel, end it, you know, just shut that voice up. You know, and that's the scary thoughts. That's the dark thoughts where you kind of think, God, I could have easily done that, you know. And that, but it kind of, to be honest with you, became a little bit more kind of common in 2015. And that's kind of when I began to realize, like, you know, I was scaring myself. So, you know, that would be the difference between just the, you know, the negative thoughts and the scary thoughts.
And you were dragging yourself deeper and deeper into this, because
deeper,
the inner monologue, as you say.
Absolutely. And then I stopped kind of, I wasn't looking after myself, eating, I wasn't exercising on a regular basis. So even as an outlet, like, stress levels were through the roof. I wasn't sleeping. I broke out in psoriasis. And again, you're trying to be this kind of healthy person, you know. But it says I already wrote a cookbook. So, you know, and now I'm kind of binging on food and kind of going long durations of the day with no food. And then I'd binge. And then it was just the whole circle. So, even my self-worth, when I looked in the mirror, who did I see? You know, I saw someone who was just not in good shape, was heavy, lethargic, was knackered, tired the whole time, was not productive, you know. And then you instantly flip back, oh, Jesus, like, I used to be really driven, motivated, what's wrong with me? You know, so you're just flipping and flopping the whole time, arguing with yourself, you know. And I think that's where the stress, because you're not listening to your gut, you know, it's all up here in the head's spinning so fast, the stress levels are through the roof, and as a result, all you're craving is high sugar foods, you know, poor quality foods, and it's just driving it the whole time.
Yeah, like I can only look at it from the outside looking in, but it seems to me that there was a mindset there that, as I say, was digging you deeper or dragging you deeper. Like, so what did Richie say, or what did you do yourself over the following months to actually change that mindset? Because it seemed that it was an attitude that if it was changed, happiness might suddenly have become an option.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and like, I know, look, Richie's been open about his own kind of journey, and that was it. I spoke to Richie and said, like, here's how I thought, and then Richie told me his story, and I remember thinking, Jesus, I wasn't the only one that thought like this, you know. And that was it. That was the big kind of change, because I thought for so long that I was the only one that had these thoughts. Nobody would understand, because nobody has ran, you know, done my sport or had the career I had, so nobody would be able to relate to me. So I just didn't talk, you know. So when someone else actually kind of told me a similar story and said how they were honest and said how they felt, I honestly remember thinking, going, right, okay, well then, straight away, I didn't feel as kind of isolated. And then through that, then when I went to counselling, that's when I began to understand the reasons as to why I was feeling and thinking certain ways, because I didn't know. You know, I just thought I shouldn't be. So I kept pushing it back. But suddenly I began to understand a little more. I began to kind of, not embrace it, but I began to kind of accept it. Mm. As to why I was feeling this way. And then when I began to accept it, I began to understand the little triggers, the things that were putting me in this place. And it could be everything from, you know, who you surround yourself with, your routine, maybe it's the lack of a good diet, lack of exercise. So when I began to understand these, then I began to kind of look at these little strategies, little tips that I was able to kind of implement, really simple things on a daily basis, and kind of went from there. So I'd almost say like I had a little toolbox, a little toolkit that, you know, and it took time. And yeah. I think this is the whole thing about people who might be struggling. You know, you go to a counsellor, you go to a psychologist and you kind of walk out, tick the box, yeah, I've done that. That's not the way it is. And, you know, the simple side of it is I trained for so many years on my physical capabilities, you know, and I still do. I still know I'm active. I need to train my mind as well. It's the same.
That's very interesting. It's mad as well that you kind of think that would become a part of your life or a part of your attitude towards life that would come so late in life. And
yeah.
I often wonder if it's any coincidence that your conversation with Richie was such a fulfilling one, because he's also an ex-sportsman. Like, I'm sure he's an excellent psychologist, but there was sort of a connection there. He understood that exact point that you made, that training yourself physically for all those years.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why I went and had a chat with him, like, off the bat, because, like, I kind of knew him kind of personally as well, and I kind of thought, you know, well, like, he has a similar background, you know, sport and everything that comes with it, and it helped. It really did. And you know, it's kind of funny because even in my career, like, I was very driven. I was very goal-orientated. I had plans, and I used to do little things to deal with my anxiety and nerves before a race. You know, simple little things about my breathing, visualization, all of these sort of stuff. But the minute I retired from sport, I just went, no, that's sport-related.
Right,
I shoved it all away. And it's funny because now I'm kind of back doing similar stuff now. You know, even in terms of breathing, anxiety and, you know, things like that. So it's funny, like, the parallels, you know, what you do in sport, you can, like, implement that in your real life as well, like, you know. So it's just, yeah, I suppose it's kind of full circle, like, you know.
How are you now?
Good, yeah, no, really good. Like, it's, I feel I've embraced life again. I've got things to look forward to. For so many years, I wouldn't commit to anything. I wouldn't put plans in place to go on holidays or anything like that because I was so worried about career or money or financials that I just wouldn't commit to anything. So I didn't really have anything to look forward to. And even with Charlotte, like she'd try and best support me, but I wasn't kind of giving her anything to look forward to. So, you know, even when Oscar was born, I think that was a big game changer as well. I think, you know, as someone that was like, I was a priority for so many years. It was all about me. You know, and even when I started going out with Charlotte, you know, Charlotte understood that my running and that was my priority. And at times that she was going to be second best. And I'll always like be so thankful for her to actually understand that. But there's a time that came when like we got married and suddenly it's not just about me. It's about Charlotte. It's about Oscar. And now it's about Olivia. And I think that has really kind of forced me to really get a benefit of and an idea of what happiness is. Like before, like we spoke about, it was all about performance. But now it's really simple things. Like we're fortunate where we live, we've got a park near us. And like going with Oscar now and watching him kick a football or ride his bike. And I know people kind of think, oh, here we go. But like that for me is, that's it. That's perfect. You know, it's not how much money I earn or any titles. And when I first retired from athletics, that's all that mattered. I needed money. I needed a title. I needed something where people say to me, what's your job? That I had an answer. You know, that's, I thought success was all about that. And I always remember someone said to me, David, how much do you need? And I remember thinking, going, what? He goes, how much do you need? And I was like, I want as much as I can get. And then afterwards, only now do I realize that was the best question. You know, how much do I need? It's not how much I want or how much, you know, more and more and more. It's like, how much do I need? If I want to live a life that, you know, I have time to spend with my kids and drop Oscar to creche in the morning time in school and stuff like that, well then, you know, how much do I need to live that life?
Yeah.
So one man's 30 grand could be another man's 130 grand.
100%. The one last thing I wanted to ask you about that, just because you mentioned it there, I do wonder if you look back on it now, would you have become as successful a sports person as you were without that mindset of, you call it selfishness, but most people would call it driven towards a singular goal?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you, Owen. I think about that. You know, I'll ask myself that question and kind of think, would it, if I was more, maybe, you know, with the mindset I have now, would I be more successful? It's hard to know. It really is hard to know. Maybe would I have had a longer career? Maybe. Would I have got the same kind of achievements? I don't know. And I think you just have to accept that, you know what, you just don't know.
Yeah, it's true. It's worrying if we have to think about that as well.
Yeah, like, look, you know, I'll be honest. Like, when people always say, oh, would you change anything? Of course I would.
Yeah.
Yeah, just certain things that I wouldn't say now that they regret, but there's definitely things that I probably might have thought twice about, or maybe gone different routes in my career and things like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm at a point now where I can honestly, happily look back at my career and go, I've done all right. Like,
yeah.
You know? So that to me is contentment. You know, like, I'll hang pictures on the wall now. I'll read back old articles. I'll kind of show Oscar races and stuff like that. You know, and that's the fact that I can do that. Like, that's brilliant.
Yeah, they're class memories. And what are you doing now to keep fit? Are you're running a little bit? You're cycling a little bit. Are you still playing a little bit of GAA?
Yeah, I went back and played a little bit junior football there with St. John's over the course of the summer. I cycle, I still run, I try and get to the gym when I can. I think the thing that I realised was, like, I do enjoy individual training, but I think what's really important is group training. I think the fact that, like, you can go and actually get in with a team is brilliant. I'm back playing a bit of soccer with my mates that I grew up with, 11-a-side, and I really love that. I absolutely love it. And again, getting out on the bike, and I think it's just a combination. You know, I probably like to be a little bit more structured, but I like kind of just getting out and just being active. So I do the park runs regularly enough and try and, like I said, get a couple of running sessions in there as well as, well, the GAA is finished now for the winter. So we'll
did you get many games this summer at all?
Well, I got to be honest, right? The GAA, to me, I have a love-hate relationship with it. You know, I grew up with GAA family, went to the Dubs, stood on the hill, did all of that sort of stuff, played senior with Ballantyre, which is great. Went back, played this year, junior football, Division 6, you know, it was brilliant, enjoyed it. But we only had 15 games and it took 8 months to get that done. You know, the season just dragged and dragged out. And I think the team I'm playing on, there's a lot of parents, you know, a lot of lads who have kids and stuff like that. And I think we all struggled with that. We all struggled with that kind of, right, we want to support our club, we want to play football, but I've also got a family and you're trying to factor in holidays, kids' holidays. And then the county board stretch a season of 15 games over 8 months. It's a joke. So what I see is a lot of lads packing in the sport because they can't balance both. Whereas, you know, I went back, like I said, and played football with my mates, 11-a-side, and we have, like, there's probably arguably the equivalent amount of games, maybe 16 games, and it's all done over 4 months. It's every week in, week out, you go and you play and that's it. Like, why can't at adult level, you know, could they not do that something like that in the GAA and keep people involved in it? Not letting people kind of go, oh, I got work, I got family, I can't commit to it. You know, if they could package the season for adult football, maybe not senior one, senior two, but certainly there has to be a level of football where it's easily played, you know, not dragging out seasons for so long. And it starts in the spring and it's depths in winter and then you're trying to fit a championship in there as well. I think you have to look at it from, okay, participation, how do we keep people in the game?
Because they're the majority. They are your groundswell of people. And also, in a lot of cases, more worryingly, to a lot of people, it's their only sport.
It's their only sport. And, you know, the interesting thing was, like, I had a lot of people come back to me off the book of sports people from elite level, from, like, European champions to medal winners, down to people who have just played at a low level or, you know, at their local club. And they'd all say the exact same thing, that they invested so much time into that they really struggled when they retired. You know, and I think, you know, we have to look at that from a point of view. It doesn't matter what walk of life or at level that you played. I think whatever way you've invested in, if it's part of you, you got to keep at it.
Yeah, 100%. There's definitely a wider discussion than that.
Yeah.
David, thank you so much for inviting us into your home. I really appreciate it. The food was amazing.
Yeah, cheers. Yeah.
It's called Back on Track, Eat, Move, Think and Rest Your Way to Your Happiest, Healthiest Self. It's David Gillick's brand new book and it comes highly recommended. David, thanks a million.
Cheers.
Yeah, great honesty there from David Gillick and great food as well. Back on Track is available now and it comes highly recommended. You can catch that back on podcast if you missed the start of the interview, or it'll be available on youtube.com/offtheball as well. Right, we've got an amazing prize this week to give away on Off The Ball. We're giving two lucky winners the opportunity to attend the Ireland versus All Blacks game in the Aviva Stadium at the amazing Aviva Fan Studio. To enter, simply head over to our Facebook page, like the page and post and tell us who you would take with you to the game. We're going to announce the winner tomorrow. And those Ireland, Northern Ireland tickets are still up for grabs. The best comment with the hashtag OTBTicks. Get those tickets. So keep your comments coming in and we'll give away those two pairs of tickets before the end of the show. You just need to come to our office near Stephen's Green to collect them before the match this evening. Right, time to turn to rugby because the Ireland team for that All Blacks game is going to be announced this afternoon. And I'm delighted to say Andy Dunn joins us on the line. Andy, good morning to you.
Morning, Owen.
So we are expecting Gerry Thornley and a lot of the other journalists this morning writing that there's going to be four changes to the Ireland team this afternoon. It's going to be announced. It's something that we expected. It's going to be Kearney, Toner, Ringrose and Levy in, Larmour, Henderson, Addison and of course Sean O'Brien dropping out from the team against Argentina. No surprises there. And I guess maybe in hindsight it's a little bit more change than Joe Schmidt wanted. I think he probably wanted a bit more consistency going into this week, but obviously needs must with the injury to Sean O'Brien.
Well, yeah, I think he would have liked Sean O'Brien to be fit. Probably looking at Sean's track record, only coming back in just in the Argentina game, having had it ultimately about 10, 11 months out of the game in an Irish jersey. When you look back at Sean's record in the British Lions series, he wasn't voted Players' Player of the tournament, but he was damn close. Jonathan Davies was voted best player of the series, the Lions against Sean O'Brien ran him a very close second. So he is, with his experience, with his how combative he is as a player, how physical he is quite a loss. However, I think we saw how strong Dan Levy is for most of last season and then dropping into the team seamlessly last week as well. I think Sean does leave a little bit of a gap. Kearney coming back in probably was always going to be the case. Toner was potentially, touch and go whether he would be selected, but I think Henderson arguably played himself out of the team. And then when the lineouts went very well with Toner back in the side, becomes to win one of these test matches. The stats in the Autumn Internationals to date have suggested anyone winning less than 70% of their lineout or 75% of their lineout is in big trouble. So Toner coming back in is probably not that much of a surprise either.
No, probably expected. Andy, we're going to give you a call back on the mobile there just because that Skype line is dropping out. But as he's been saying there, we're expecting four changes to the Ireland team to be announced this lunchtime. Kearney, Toner, Ringrose and Dan Levy coming in for Larmour, Henderson, Addison and the injured Sean O'Brien. We'll get Andy's take on who he thinks should make the bench. A couple of decisions, a couple of spots up for grabs there between, say, Addison and Larmour for the 23 jersey. But Josh van der Fleer make it ahead of Murphy, Ruddock and Conan. That remains to be seen. We'll know this afternoon. Also, the All Blacks team has been announced this morning. Of course, they were up early. Ryan Crotty replacing Sonny Bill Williams in the only change to their team that beat narrowly England last week. Just a reminder that you're watching OTBAM and it's brought to you this morning with Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with the choice of over 20,000 quality trade products. A reminder once again that Republic of Ireland versus Northern Ireland tickets are going and we'll get to them in just a moment. In terms of who the best comments are, I'm hearing that there are plenty of great puns coming in. So
top better than your starting block pun.
No, well, that's just like the goat in terms of puns. Like that.
I'm going that far now.
Well, it literally halved our viewers this morning, so that's how good a pun it was. It actually had a seismic effect on people's behaviour.
Our praise was mildly sarcastic, not actual praise, just to be clear.
Andy Dunn, you're back.
I am. Apologies for that.
Not at all. Listen, let's talk about the bench because it's quite interesting. I think when we were looking at this team announcement that was going to happen this afternoon, everybody was saying that this is going to be the most important team announcement because we thought Conor Murray might be in the mix and we thought that there might be a decision, a bit more of a decision in the back row. That's not turned out with a couple of injuries, but the bench, he's got big decisions to make. I make it Addison versus Larmour and whether or not Josh van der Fleer makes it ahead of the other back row options as the two big calls for Joe Schmidt. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest call of those two, given that Larmour and Addison are both very versatile and cover multiple positions, I don't think that's going to give them as much of a headache. I think what's going to give them the headache in the bench decision is who could cover number 8, for example, if CJ Stander were to get an injury. Would he look at the likes of O'Mahony, who hasn't played there much, to slot in from 6?
or would he, if he goes with Van der Fleer as a like-for-like replacement for Levy to start, it does mean he's got a bit of a hole at number eight should Stander get injured. So in that case, I think it brings Jack Conan right back into the mix as an option. I would be very surprised in a game of such significance if he was to simply replace the likes of Levy with an immediate like-for-like replacement such as Van der Fleer, who won't cover other back row positions. I think he needs to be assured, you know, if God forbid something happened, CJ Stander after 2 minutes, and we didn't have an out-and-out number eight as an option to replace him, it could be really challenging. You know, there's a lot of specialist skills involved in that number eight role, right down to how you control the ball at the base of the scrum and how you use it and how you work with your nine. You'll have a different role in the line-out in terms of lifting or jumping, if you like, Sikonen. And so there are specialist tasks involved in that, and I would be surprised if he doesn't have a number eight on the bench just as backup.
Right, OK. Just a quick word on the All Blacks team. Ryan Crotty is in for Sonny Bill Williams, a change we expected. It's kind of more continuity than Steve Hansen has actually had the luxury of enjoying over the last couple of months, which makes them gives them this added dimension of danger.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've had a dimension of danger for as long as I can remember. they have huge resources, and to see the likes of Crotty run onto the fizz last week after... Well, you just get the impression of how strong and vast their depth is. They've a huge playing squad, and there's some interesting stats. Up until recent history, the average All Black was only capped 25-50 times. Now, that trend has been bucked somewhat in recent years. In the last 10 years, a number of stalwarts from the McCaw era, the likes of McCarthy, McCall, Mialamu, Conrad Smith, Manonu, were all over 100 caps. So up until recent history, the trend in New Zealand rugby was nobody really got more than 25-30 caps because they just weren't given that opportunity, and the guys behind them were coming through strong. They still have that strength and depth, but they've had a bit more consistency in selection. I think that was predicated on the fact that they couldn't quite win World Cup, and they decided to stick with players, give them opportunities for longer periods and grow a team over a lengthy period, which they did, and obviously was vindicated winning back-to-back World Cups. So there is a lot of experience. Well, I'd rather say there's a lot of ability in this All Blacks group, but not as much experience as the groups that won World Cups. There's not too many guys across the breadth of the team that have 100 caps plus. And in that sense, Ireland are probably a bit more settled.
Yeah, in terms of combinations, and it plays into exactly what you're saying there, there's plenty of experience there as well. Whitelock and Retallick packing down together for, I think, the 50th time together, which is an incredible stat for any international side. Like, when it comes to second-row partnerships, are these two guys the best we've ever seen in world rugby?
Yeah, I mean, they're right up there. In terms of their contribution on the field, together and as individuals, they have changed how lock forwards are viewed. Retallick tends to carry a ball 17 to 20 times a game. Something we've seen similarly with James Ryan now is the kind of the new wave of young Irish talent that are coming through and matching the likes of Retallick. But yeah, I mean, when you think back to great second row combinations, you know, Ireland would have had the likes of Lenehan and Neil Francis, and England would have in the 80s, famous ones like Ackford and Dooley. There's been some great French combinations. But these guys have kind of taken it to the next level, and their longevity as a partnership adds a huge amount of value, given their role in the scrum and how important it is, how consistent it is for your front row to have guys behind you that you know are going to add value in the scrum. And then obviously both huge line-out threats, both extremely high work rate around the field, and their contributions numerically, you know, as individuals, you're getting into the high 30s in terms of tackles, ball carries, and effective rucks hit. So, yeah, I suppose they've changed the template for second row play.
What can we learn from how England failed last week in terms of the broader Italic factor?
Well, the one thing I picked up from last week was that we could learn is I think the All Blacks are a little bit off the boil. I think they're at the end of an 18-month cycle. And when matched physically as they were with England, they just didn't seem as sharp as normal. When most teams would do their best to match an All Black side physically for 15 to 20 minutes, and they give a tiny chink of light, and the All Blacks' skill level and decision making, their shot manages to create a gap. And
I think we're just breaking up with you there, Andy. I think we might leave that line for the time being, but I think you were. We got from that the idea that he kind of agrees with the idea that Retallick and Whitelock are probably the two best we've seen in that position over the last couple of years. We might try and re-establish Andy a little later on, or we might not. We'll bring you up to speed on that over the next couple of minutes. We are going to return to our breakfast menu because we didn't get this all done.
You only get two
on.
Strikes. Two
you
strikes.
Only get, I was thinking yeah. two strikes. I think two strikes is where we leave it. There will be plenty more rugby, do not worry, over the next couple of days on Off the Ball. We're going to have Shane Byrne in studio tomorrow morning, actually, and Alan Quinlan as well, and Jamie Heaslip coming up on Saturday's Off the Ball as well. So plenty of content coming your way. So we've gone through Obafemi, we've gone through Whelan's critics. Mon v Mon, Michael v Martin this evening. What's their relationship like?
Yeah, it's hard to know. They were at a, there was a cooperation dinner last night. I think it's on the back of the Indo this morning, a picture from it. And it was like an event arranged, you know, around the around this game. And I suppose it is interesting that the relationship between the associations is very mixed in recent years, that we've had these scraps over eligibility and players. The flip side of that is there's also a joint bid being launched at the moment to host an All-Ireland Under-21 Championships in 2023. So, yeah, there we have them shaking hands. Now, you know, you'd be at various draws and stuff like that, and, you know, the Euro 2016 draw and various coaches' symposiums and all this stuff. And I got the impression that the relationship between the coaches was pretty good. Even 3 years ago, it was a behind closed doors friendly here where Northern Ireland came down to play here, just with 50 fans at it, or 50 sort of specially picked ball boys, I think, at it, FAI friends. But I think since then the relationship is cool. I don't think that would be a massive stretch to say that. And that goes back to earlier this year in the interview that Michael O'Neill gave, where I suppose he was quite critical of the Republic's recruitment policy. Now, some quotes he said, some were attributed to them that I don't know, were they meant to be used or whatever, whatever way that you can discuss it. But certainly some of the language used at the time, or that was reported at the time, offended Martin O'Neill. And there was a bit of a, I suppose, back and forth over the whole thing. And I think Martin O'Neill was offended that he was being accused of sort of recruiting players, when actually a lot of the recruiting of, say, Northern Irish-born players has happened at underage levels. So I think there might be a small, maybe a frostiness there, just lingering beneath the surface, or certainly a competitive edge there that maybe wasn't there before. And also, I'd say Martin O'Neill several times has been told about what a good job Michael O'Neill is doing with tighter resources. So that in itself would breed a bit of a competitive enmity, I guess, you know?
I can only add to tonight.
Yeah, I think that's funny. I was speaking to someone yesterday who said, or it was actually this morning, I think like some of the Northern Irish papers today, I think the Belfast Telegraph was going big on like Stephen Davis quote saying there's going to be a real edge to this game. And I think...
Do you subscribe to that?
I don't know. I'm not so sure. I think
Martin O'Neill was saying that if it was in Belfast, he'd be worried about James McLean. Like, is that too simplistic to say, oh, it's in Dublin, it's going to be fine?
Well, I just, the Aviv is obviously a bigger venue, and there's talk of maybe more free tickets being handed out. But there will be a couple of thousand travelling fans down who are going to make a day out of it. They'll be boisterous and, you know, they might make a bit of noise and give it a bit of atmosphere. And if McLean is involved, there'll be a bit of a spark in it, I'd say. I don't think it'll be a typical international football friendly, but I'm not saying it's going to have the intensity of a... I think a competitive match between the two now would be ferocious. I do. I really do think it would be. And I think going to Belfast is still a challenge. I mean, Michael Duffy from the Dock is the player that Michael O'Neill is speaking about in a few of the papers today. He is going through a switch at the moment. That is a senior level switch. And we've had the thing over Jimmy Dunn, where Michael O'Neill joking last week that he owed him two cappuccinos and almost having a poke, you know. Amazingly, he played 15 minutes for the Under-21s. He's now in the senior squad. It must have been the best 15 minutes ever. So I'm just saying, Benitez, I don't think there is a closeness there.
No, it doesn't seem that way, but it doesn't seem as vitriolic as some people might suggest. Either.
No, I think it's I think it's somewhere in between. I think a lot of like passive aggressive jibes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, what's he really mean there? You know, but I don't think they're going to be squabbling on the sideline.
What are you looking at from tonight's game? Obviously, like the return from Robbie Brady is the big thing, and there is kind of the lingering idea of Denmark. No matter what happens on Monday, no matter what sort of performance we put in, are we going to get 3 points there? And even if we do, we would need some sort of miracle, really, at this point to kind of save ourselves from being doomed.
Yeah, well, actually, I think if Denmark take a positive result from Wales on Friday, I think we're confirmed effectively for bottom spot, the way things are looking. So, yeah, Monday could end up being a dead rubber. But in terms of tonight, yeah, I mean, obviously, we've sort of discussed Obafemi, but if he actually just played at some point, it would be interesting. I think Sean Maguire is an interesting one. I think Maguire has got a lot of positive mentions from O'Neill in dispatches recently, and he only came on against Wales last month, but he was coming off an injury, and he looked sharp. But I think a good proper outing for Maguire in Dublin, I think that would be worth it. I think even Maguire and Callum Robinson linking up together could be interesting. And yeah, the use of Robbie Brady, will he play him at left back or the left side, or will he try and put him into a creative midfield role and say, this is your gig from now on, this is the next stage of your career? There was also a hint that with Matt Doherty being out, that we might go back to a flat back four. We'll see. I mean, it just, to me, like if you commit to a change of formation, you try it in two games last month, to revert back so soon, you'd want that to work, or else you're left open to accusations that you're just fiddling around here, you don't know what's best.
Yeah.
So, but where Seamus Coleman plays within that is another talking point too. So there is some interesting aspects to this game that we do have. Like Ireland, like, do have a reasonable size squad in terms of options, and there are some players who could benefit from a proper game. So it may not be as sort of I don't know, you know, the lack of enthusiasm that there is around some Ireland games these days. I understand why that is, and I don't think we can, you know, you can lie and manufacture enthusiasm where it's not there. But at the same time, the likes of Maguire and Robinson and Coleman and Brady being back, at least there's something, you know, something to watch the game for tonight.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the idea that it's a derby as well, like, you can paint it all you want politically, but it's still a derby. If it was Wales against England, in Wembley or in the Millennium, it would be like, oh, this is a game that's going to have a bit of atmosphere, and it's a game that we're all interested in. I think you can look at it in black and white terms like that and say, it's Ireland against Northern Ireland. It's two nations beside each other. It's in Dublin, and it's a game that, I guess, every game right now for Ireland, in terms of friendly, in terms of building any sort of hope for the supporters, is important. So there's plenty there to cling on to.
And the away fans will be up for it. There is no doubt about that. It's a bit like Ireland going to Wembley a couple of years back. The away fans will be up for it. The home fans might get into it.
Yeah, for sure. Let's move on to Wayne Rooney. It's the penultimate item on our breakfast menu. His send-off tonight. It's interesting, the discourse around this. Obviously, Peter Shilton saying, I don't think you can give out caps like gifts, so he's not up for it. Tommy Martin in the Irish Examiner this morning says, Rooney is a ghost of tournament failures past, returned from beyond the international grave, like a zombie wielding multiple dog-eared, ghost-written autobiographies, which is a pretty good way of describing Wayne Rooney, the sort of personification of a failed golden era. And there's sort of a deep resentment from a large section of past England players and England supporters.
Yeah, it's I mean, it was 120th cap, or he's in like a serious amount of appearances. And yeah, I don't have a huge issue with Rooney being brought back for a farewell against USA. I can see, but I mean, there is a cynical commercial value to it. But I guess he didn't necessarily get to have some kind of proper goodbye, and he still has probably earned some opportunity. You can debate whether he should have been. We have this with Glenn Whelan tonight. Do you give them a cap, or do you bring them out at half time for a round of applause? I mean, I can argue that. I mean, I saw Gareth Southgate yesterday having a chat about, you know, at his press conference about, well, some of the players haven't met Rooney before, and it's a good chance for them to like talk and absorb, you know, those little chats around the hotel.
That's stretching it a bit, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I imagine Wayne Rooney is around the hotel with the lads going, so what was the whole World Cup thing like?
Yeah.
You know, tell us about some of your World Cup stories.
Yeah.
They'll be sort of worn down, like beaten down. Oh no, geez, he tells, apparently international football is really bad, according to this lad over here. So I also saw Gareth Southgate the line yesterday that the unity in the England squad is such now that they were watching TV yesterday with a picture of Danny Welbeck next to it.
Oh,
the
my
injured
God.
Danny Welbeck. I say Wayne Rooney's sitting there going,
geez, it was more crack with Sven. Yeah. You know, there'd be a bit more going around. There's a bit more going on around the hotel when Sven was here than this bloody garbage, you know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a guy from ITV, I think, put it out there yesterday. He was like, it's riding a fine line with sort of Partridge territory as well. You know, the lads are sitting there watching. There's a picture of Danny, like Neymar style, buried. Like Neymar died during the World Cup in Brazil.
And do you think instead of a little poppy, they'll have a little face of Danny Welbeck on their jersey?
That's what they should do. That would be a real commemorative. Giant Danny Welbeck is unfurled on the pitch before the game. As Wayne Rooney comes out. So maybe Rooney's come back on, this is like kids these days are just way too emotional.
Yeah.
But this is this unity that they've built up. So do you want to bring Wayne back into it? You know?
Yeah, that's the thing.
But he probably deserves it. I wouldn't be taking it too seriously.
Another thing that Gareth Southgate has been speaking about is the quote, which is their final point this morning. So if you missed the story this week, the FA are planning post-Brexit to reduce overseas players from 25-man squad is what you have. So you
can register 25-man squad in the league. Yeah.
You used to be able to have 17 overseas players. They're going to reduce that to 12. The material impact really is not going to be that much. Martin Ziegler in the Times this morning saying that only 3 clubs would really be affected by it. It's going to be the benches that are going to change. And that's exactly what Gareth Southgate is saying, that if you want to promote homegrown British talent, then this isn't necessarily going to give you the carrot.
No, and the definition of overseas is important here as well, because, and people wonder what this means from an Irish context, that if you've spent 3 years before the age of 21 on the books of an English club, then you actually count as homegrown in these criteria that exist at the moment. So, for example, someone like Robbie Brady, who went across Manchester United at 15, 16, he would count as a homegrown player. Now, there's a couple of strands to what's going on here this week, because we have the broader Brexit picture and what that will mean for recruiting players under the age of 18. And that could have knock-on implications for Irish players. It depends, because if you're signing players from outside EU at the moment, FIFA have issues with clubs, English clubs at the moment. It's through FIFA ruling that signing players from outside the EU before the age of 18 is an issue. Obviously, England are now moving outside of the EU, so it needs to be clarified where the relationship with the Republic of Ireland will stand, because there's a common travel area. But I mean, by the letter of the law at the moment, it would appear that there might be implications for Irish lads going across. So the broader point, yeah, I think Gareth Southgate is, I can see where he's coming from. It's not going to make a huge difference, and that quotas as a principle don't necessarily work. Now, the strange thing has been England are excellent at underage level at the moment, like really good. They've won the World Cup at 20 level. And one of the frustrations for Gareth Southgate is that a lot of those guys aren't playing regularly, whereas ironically Declan Rice is, and that's why he came onto his radar, that he was a young lad playing regular football, whereas a lot of the English stars haven't, and that's why some have gone to Germany and wherever it might be. So there is a slightly change in picture, and there could be knock-on implications for Ireland here, but we're sort of unclear to what extent just yet.
It is the big time of the show. It's time to give away these tickets, a couple of pairs of tickets to Republic of Ireland against Northern Ireland this evening. Our first winner is Patrick Conway, who has come up with just a list of sublime puns. Like, congratulations, Patrick, fully deserving. Owen cracking eggs, you're some yolk, he says, hashtag OTB. That's worse than my pun earlier on.
I mean, there's better ones to come, right?
Let's hope so. Just kidding, Owen is an egg-cellent presenter. I'm gonna take that right there. What's the connection between eggs in today's game? The scramble for tickets? And then he says, in relation to David Gillick showing us a smoothie, I'd like a ticket at a reduced price. So congratulations.
He's earned
to you,
those
Patrick.
Tickets.
You've earned a pair of tickets. Also, Isil Cody wins a pair. She asks, is there a level of hypocrisy in our uproar about Rice, who is English and lives there, when we have the likes of Bundy in our rugby squad, and defend that?
Oh, well, of course.
I'm keen to always get your take whenever there's a rugby soccer comparison.
Listen, when that line was falling earlier, I was like, he's going to have to turn to be on New Zealand here. This could be an issue.
There is Dennis Walsh, actually.
You touched on that today. Yeah, I know. And I know the rugby rules are different again. And each sport almost has its own code that you become, you know, the respective authorities adapt to that. But yeah, I can see that argument. The connection between Declan Rice and Ireland would be stronger than a lot of our rugby players. But then people sometimes, there's two different schools of thought. Some people are very emotive and it would be Kev Coban's point that they want that genuine connection there. You need to know who you are. But increasingly in sport, those factors aren't being applied to international sport, whether it's rugby, whether it's football, whatever it might be. You see it in the Olympics, you see it in athletics. And it's strange that sometimes it is the footballers are described, well, these guys are the mercenary figures picking and choosing. But at least when they play, the Irish diaspora, they are representing a part of our history in some way. Like the Irish history of emigration is one of it. It creates complex identity issues the further you go generationally. Whereas obviously the rugby one, there's only one way of describing it.
It's taking advantage of the rules.
Yeah, but everyone's doing it. Like New Zealand do it. So you can't, again, no one can take a moral high ground too much on this when everyone's at it. And at the high end of football as well, I mean, Diego Costa, you know, this happens. Yeah. You know, residency is used by other countries where they have established professional football industries to take people there on residency basis. So, you know, no one can be too judgmental about it, really.
No, for sure. Dennis Walsh should say it's not too late for the IRFU to reflect and stop. He's calling for a cessation of that sort of ability to be able to bring someone like Bundee Aki into the national team. I guess the closest comparison to Declan Rice in the rugby team is Will Addison, who's kind of signed from Sale this year and obviously has Irish heritage. But that's an interesting one, the comparison between there. I think once you start getting into the realms of comparison between football and soccer in this, you end up
like two drunks in a bar, you know, going round in circles again and again and again.
On that note, I think we're going to leave it there for this morning before we kind of delve into any deeper into the grey areas of international.
It's too early to be drunk at a bar as well.
No, it's actually perfect time. I think 9:25 is actually perfect. I think that's where we're off to now after this. That is our lot this morning. Just to let you know, you can podcast the show on Spotify. Just search for OTBAM in Spotify. We're also available wherever else you get your pods. And as you should know by now, we post all our best stuff across Off the Ball to our YouTube channel. Just head over to youtube.com/offtheball to subscribe. Dan McDonald, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We will hear more from Dan very shortly, and you can read his report on tonight's fascinating game. I'm sure it's going to be a cracker in tomorrow's Irish Independent. Off the Ball is back on your airwaves from 7 o'clock this evening on News Talk and across all our social platforms. We'll chat to you here tomorrow morning on OTB AM from 7:45 AM. Bye bye for now.
OTB AM.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.